Welcome to Small Beam Records Music Podcast. This is episode 9 with our guest, Heinbach.
Hi.
Hey, nice to have you. Do you want to go ahead and give yourself like a little introduction for people who may not know who you are?
I'm Heinbach. I'm an electronic musician from Berlin. I compose electronic music and I talk about experimental music techniques on my YouTube channel.
Yeah, so I've been watching your channel now for, I don't know, probably a year and a half.
And oh, I've been that's long.
Yeah, I think one of the things that caught me the most was some of the more experimental stuff you've been doing. That's been really drawn me back to the channel, actually. So, yeah, I guess we'll start off with some talking about some of your cooler things right now, in my opinion, like the lab equipment. So, what was the idea behind using that stuff?
I studied musicology back at university, and there I got in touch with all these, with the works of Stockhausen, for example, and the early electronic music schools like the Cologne School, that was Stockhausen, and Pierre Schaeffer, which was Paris, Ina GRM, completely disparate schools of thought. But I got fascinated by the techniques that they used. And I've ever since been trying to recreate that. The first time I tried something with test equipment was using the software called Berna, which just got, I think, updated to number 2. And everybody keeps tweeting me about, have you checked this out? I haven't since version 1, which was like 2007, 2008 or something. And that just piqued my interest. And I felt like I like to explore stuff, and that to me, in all the kind of like consumerism preset world that we live in with the synthesizers, how they are created now, I found that I was looking for something different. And 2 years ago, I met Dennis Verschoor at the Wavefrom Research Center in Rotterdam, who built in this tiny space a studio full of old test equipment. I didn't understand it then, really. It was like, what's this? And there was a guy, Joe Canese, doing residencies there. And he said, oh, this doesn't work. This is crazy. This sounds crazy. This doesn't work. This is complicated. And it sounded, okay, this sounds like a lot of work. And indeed it is. And at some point this year, Dennis just, I think he posted like, what you have to buy to get into this on his Facebook site. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And he basically enabled me to start my own search, and I quickly found stuff that he also didn't know about, and then I found stuff that he recommended. And in the Netherlands, there's a big scene for that. I mean, big is mean like probably 20 people, maybe. we're talking about big scene.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I get and similar to the way that my modular Eurex synthesizer expanded. This has expanded exponentially because everything is really cheap, most of the things. There's some things that are expensive, but most of these things, they cost $30, $40, $50 or euros, and but they only come up once. So when you see them, you have to get them. There's no second chance. Or maybe there might be, but that might be a half a year off or a year. So I just bought a lot of stuff, and it turned from just a small corner to a tower. And every new thing that I discover, sometimes I find stuff locally that nobody else has ever seen and known what it was used for. But that's super exciting to just meet someone. He said, I'm just cleaning out the garage of my grandfather. So because he died a year ago. So that's where you get most of the stuff from. Basically dead man, and that's difficult difference to tape recorders and like dictaphones. Tape recorders you get from dead women, dead grandmothers, and they smell of lavender. And test equipment usually smells of cigarette smoke and oil and garage. Two different.
Yeah.
It's really really gendered in that regard, but yeah. So, and when I first put together a pair of oscillators and listened to the pure sound, I was amazed because it sounded so pure and raw, and it would overdrive like all my mixers and effects units, and I even killed like a Moogafogger effect with that. But while while it was working, it sounded so great because the level was so hot that the Moogafogger just went into this bliss mode and produced all these overtones that sounded beautiful. After that point, it went tilt, and I was like, nope, I can't take this anymore. So you have to be really careful with the output levels that these can produce. And but the raw sound of that captured me. And then I got addicted to the, basically, you know, the game Doom?
Yeah.
There's different difficulties. So you've got like regular synthesizers, please don't hurt me. And then you've got modular synthesizers, which are a bit average, a bit more. And then you go up to, so this is really like nightmare mode.
Because
to get these things to do something musical is really hard. Because what they want to do is be like, tick, 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 burp. They just want to drone on for days. They don't care for like different pitches or something. You have to find all these ways to go around that. And thinking in that way and being challenged to think in that way made me really appreciate it. It tickled my brain in all the right parts. And now I'm applying all the techniques that I learned patching test equipment to my modular patching or patching synthesizers and everything. And it's much calmer. I think it makes me a better player on all the other instruments too, because I do a lot less, which is always something I'm striving for, to do less and less and less. And it sharpened my mind for that out of necessity. And it helps you to think outside of the box, because none of these things wants to work together in a musical way. So you have to force them and to guide them and to surprise yourself with what can happen if they work.
Yeah, that's one of the coolest things that I saw, because there's not a lot of people who are currently doing that kind of stuff. And that really appealed to me, I think, because I had this kind of feeling that whenever I like work on like using a classical synthesizers and stuff, the interface, you know, it works so well with itself that it almost doesn't provide the challenge of working around certain restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so when I saw you using the test equipment and stuff, that was like, wow, that's really sweet. And one of the other things that really drew me in originally was, I never know how to pronounce it, the Kate Lombard.
She had Lombard?
I've never had a chance to mess around with any of those. What are your like thoughts on those?
That was after Eurorack. This was for me a completely new world, and a world that I love, because even with the Eurorack, I was trying to build each of the boxes, each of the racks, as a self-contained instrument. That was always the goal, but that gets quickly derailed as you get more Eurorack and more stuff. It's really hard to think of it as one instrument. And when I got the Seat Lombard, my first, I was like, oh, this is self-contained instrument, but it's very open, just patch point for everything. You can break out everything. So it feels like a modular, and then you get another piece, and then this is also like, you can do all the things that you can do with a modular, but it's a self-contained instrument. Mm-hmm. And then you get the third piece. And what I'm only just now realizing is how much fun you can have if you get into interpatching all of these things and stop using them as like, okay, this is an instrument, this is an instrument, and this is an instrument. So basically like an orchestra, and you think of this is my bass, this is my harmonies, this is my space in which everything happens. And then you, same as with a modular, you melt all of these things together. So it becomes this gloriously everything can be everything kind of environment. And when I got from, because I play these live and I'm trying to get really good at improvising on them. And that's part of why I started my YouTube channel. It was to get better at improvising, because the first videos that I uploaded are just me sitting down and playing for half an hour with my Seat Lombard gear. and the camera was like the audience, so I couldn't stop and I had to do this. Okay, so now I've got 28, 30 minutes and I have to perform and deliver. So every time I get back to that, I'm fascinated about the possibilities and the playability of it all. And it might seem daunting at first. I mean, but it's one level in difficulty wise, it's one level below test equipment. So because it is made with a musical mind, and Peter is a very musical ideas and architectural ideas and art ideas. And it's not just an engineering piece as his test equipment. So there's so much in there that you can discover. And what I found, that some people find that they think, oh, that's Seattle Lombard that has this sound. No, it doesn't. It doesn't have, you can morph the sound. It can be many things. It does have a distinctive sound, but you can play around with that sound, and you can use stuff like the Plumbutter, for example, which is the drum and drama machine. You can use that as a fantastic mixer and modulator instead of the drum and drama machine. So it becomes something different. It becomes a different sort of instrument. And that's something I'm trying to discover now with all of these, so that they, again, can be used in different ways. And I feel I still got so much more to discover with these instruments. And the beautiful thing is that they are very playable live, and you can master them, and you can do stuff like, if you give me three, like the what's that game called when you prompt someone to improvise on something, like in theater. So you give like beach, rain, and the purple swan, which was something that actually happened during the workshop when I was presenting these instruments. And I can do that. I can do the beach, I can do the rain, and I can do a purple swan with these instruments. But it's very possible to compose on them, to compose what's in your head, to put that into the instrument. And it's also possible to go into straight chaos and to just let accidents happen. But it's important for me to say that once you get to a certain level with these instruments, you've got control.
Yeah, I've been looking at them for, like, I don't know, months now, considering buying one. And I think I'm probably going to go through and I've never heard a bad review about them, you know. So to kind of dig farther in, where did you start from with music? Like, what background did you come from?
I had piano lessons when I was six. And I had to do all the stuff that you have to do when you have piano lessons. You have to do a recital, like when you go to school, and you have to do a play at high school. And you have to play, like, when you are in the sixth grade, you have to play for the new arriving fifth graders and stuff like that, which was my first live performance with music, which I completely messed up. But then I played it again. Instead of leaving the stage, I just said, no, I'm going to do this. And I would love to say that I was super good in the second run, though. It was, again, horrible, but at least I made it through the piece. So, but that kind of killed stage fright for me. But then I played a lot of game music. I recorded game music from Amiga games to tape, gave that to my piano teacher, and had her transcribe it on notes. So I did that.
Oh, okay.
And at age 15, I got asked, do you want to play in the band that me and my sister are doing? And I said, okay, what are you doing? Yeah, psychedelic rock. And and I joined the psychedelic rock bands, a rock band in the Black Forest, like in a small town. And we played music in the basement. And when I first played live with that band, and the first time was with the keyboard, everything on stage, it transformed me. And that was age 15. And I said, I just want to do everything that I can, get this feeling of being on stage, playing music. That is what I want for the rest of my life. And I've been trying to do that since. And I got bands, and I do a lot of composing work. And the goal was always to make music, to make more music.
I like that. Yeah. Actually, I just played my first live show 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fantastic. I turned it half into a talk, actually. So halfway through, I started talking to the audience about like the history of the synthesizers, which they surprisingly were not bored. So that was good. But
there's a tradition here in Germany. It's called Gesprächskonzerte. It's concerts where you talk about what you're doing, about the instruments and stuff. That's something that Andreas Schneider, who basically is one of the main promoters of modular instruments in Europe, is very strongly about, to do these Gesprächskonzerte. Have composers, have musicians play and then engage in a talk, have them play more and then do a talk. So it becomes something that can be explained. So it loses the black box, that these modern electronic instruments, or like not even modern, old electronic instruments can be.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out for some more. I've been playing piano since I was six also, actually. So I completely get where you're coming from about that stuff. What do you think it was that made you want to start doing like electronic music specifically?
Oh, that is something that started really early, because the first thing that I bought for the band was this secondhand Yamaha Entertainer keyboard with all the presets, but it had one good organ sound. And I started looking for better sounds, and I didn't have any money, and because I was a student. So I checked out radio, and I turned the radio to the far left, and then there's all these FM frequencies and noises, and that was my first synthesizer basically that I could afford. And then I used that and the piano and the tape recorder. So I had a piano playing on the right hand. I had a pattern I had pre-programmed into the keyboard running, and then I had the tape like the radio going, and was morphing that and introducing white noise. And then I was recording everything straight to a small cassette player. That was really early on when I started out with the band just to add more sounds. So, and that's pretty similar to what I'm doing now, actually. But but really raw in that sense. And then, of course, As I mentioned before, I was also playing computer games, and on the computers there was stuff like on Amiga there were trackers, and I started I used trackers before a bit for fun, and then there was this program called Cool Edit 69 that was an amazing audio editor where you could synthesize tones, and you could have effects, and you could have cut up vocals, cut up lyrics, cut up everything, record something, and basically it's one of the best editing suits that I still know. And I use that to create music and sometimes get around school assignments, because there were books that I really hated. There's Effie Briest, I don't know what's the English name of that. I hated that book by Thomas Mann, and I didn't want to read it, so I kind of skimmed through it and then created a musical piece instead of like an essay about the book, where I contrasted the hymn of Prussian's glory, like a military march, with a gentle piano melody, and then the two faded into each other and crossed over and distorted and broke apart the gentle piano melody. So that was how I got out reading that book. By creating an art piece. So
yeah, that's awesome. A lot of American teachers usually won't accept that.
I was lucky in that regard. We had a very good German teacher. Yeah, he was really open to all this stuff. So
Yeah, I think it's awesome. I really think that people should grow up, especially people who are interested in music, with an environment that allows people to, you know, do more expressive compositions and things like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super nice. I mean, back in the day, the only like minds that I could find was John Peel on the radio. So I would listen to John Peel, and the first time I heard it was like, this sounds like bombs are dropping in a bunker. It was some noise ambient track dark, and I was like, this is this music? What is this? I've never heard of this. And I tried to find out, but which was really hard because there was no internet. There was, you had to call the small radio station that was running recorded tapes from his show, and you would never reach the people that would like play that show. So it was never a track list or anything. So it was hard to get to stuff. It got a little better when something like World of Music came around. No, when MTV came around, and they had some of these really good music shows that were on late at night, Alternative Nation, I think, and another one more indie orientated. And there was actually some good music programming in there. And yeah, I discovered a lot of stuff through that, like Aphex Twin, of course, which was mind-blowing. And so, yeah. But it was hard. What I'm getting is, like, it was super hard to reach anyone with that. And I was really alone, like, in this lush Black Forest village, like, the area with the kind of music that I was doing. So part of what I'm doing now is trying to create communities and to talk about these techniques to make them more mainstream, or like not mainstream, but make them more known, maybe, you know?
Right.
So to get people that are interested in that together and make it something, look, this is how you do it. It's something that can be open. Try it, explore. It doesn't have to be all this formulated marketing bullshit that you get thrown at all the time. Try something and enjoy. And I find people all over the world that are interested in that, and it's lovely to see them connecting. That's why I do stuff like the a subreddit, where I try to get people together, or a Discord where people can chat. And it's really beautiful for me to see all these connections happening, because it's something that I would have loved to have had when I was 15.
Yeah, I definitely get that. And that's almost exactly why we started the podcast, actually. The biggest thing for me, as like starting off as music as well, was, you know, getting to know other musicians that weren't like just random people, you know, getting to know people that can actually help out with music and give you important advice. So we figured, you know, let's just get in touch with people that have done something successful related to music, and then let's just chat, you know? So I guess the reason that we really wanted to have you on here was, when it comes to like internet nowadays, which is like the biggest thing that we usually try to touch on and make a big point of in the podcasts, people like my age and younger, you know, we grew up with the internet and stuff, and people that are older and kind of had the pre-internet experience as well, there's always such a distinct difference, you know? So I guess, what would your opinion be on, do you think the internet, as obviously it has so many amazing advantages, do you think the access to so much information has negatively impacted like the music world and creativity in general?
For me, I can say not. For me, it's been a perfect way to connect and to get to get my music to the people that are interested in it. So from my personal side, the internet has been nothing but good to me. And it's, I wouldn't say that it impacts creativity, because I think it enlarges creativity, because more people can make music now and can distribute it and can put it on SoundCloud and can put it on even like Spotify and everything for just a small fee. All the gatekeeping is gone that used to block you in the past. And you have to find all new ways to get heard, of course, which is as difficult back then as it today as it was back then. But at least, especially like in niche genres in which I live in, or much of the music that I love, is this has been a boon, I think. So but generally, I think the approach that I had to the internet was always more of a, this is something I work with thing. Because, I mean, like when it came around, I was 15, 16, I was just 16, I think. And it was the first thing where you could do like dial up. And then I went to the Radiohead fan forums and talked about Radiohead. I think that was the only thing I ever did like in 97, 98 to go to Radiohead forums. But then quickly, I worked as a graphic when I was studying. I did because as a musician, you also have to do the cover art and everything and posters and everything. So I learned basically Photoshop and all that stuff by making artwork and posters. And then I got a job as a graphic artist for a few .coms, because that was the time of the first .com boom. And I was working on the internet really on and making good money for a student job. It was crazy because everybody was doing startups and it was a crazy atmosphere. None of these companies survived. And there's some great stories in there. Why? Because they were all bullshit. But but still, I encountered it as something to work with and to use, and not something that is something to express yourself as your social media or something. Social media didn't exist. It wasn't social media. It was HTML websites and Angelfire and stuff like that. And you would use it for information. And then I remember when Google came around, and professor said, oh, there's this new thing called Google. If you want to do your research, you should check that out. I goes, okay, we'll try Google. So yeah, it's a different approach. It's not, it wasn't there. It became a key that unlocked a whole lot of things.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Real quick. And the Radiohead, we just had a guest on last who, big Radiohead fan. Do you think that their music, like Johnny Greenwood and stuff, influenced your interest in more experimental, strange stuff?
It influenced my interest in songwriting, because I was a really big fan in the way that they would write songs like Street Spirit that were incredible minimalistic and used abstract imagery and small changes that would create these endless movies in your head. And then there was OK Computer, which was similarly amazing in that regard, in the way that songwriting and sound would tell the story. And it never felt bloated to me. It always felt interesting and serving to a song. I stopped being such a fan after Kid A came around, because there I could hear the influences. Because by that time, I'd dug through the Warp and Reflex catalog 3 times. And basically, I could hear where they got the beats from Idiotech. I could hear all the references. And I was like, so you took this, and you took this, and you took this. So that, I mean, for the band itself, it must have been freeing to go there and beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I was like, okay, where's the songwriting? Where's the songwriting now? Where is it? And that was for a time something that they lost and then got back again and always drifting in between. But basically, for me, as I was a big fan then, I needed them to write great songs. I think somebody put like that can make a butterfly cry, and I had my experimental needs covered by other people that really, and they were doing the experimental side so much better and so much more interesting to me. So
so who were some of the more experimental musicians that you had listened to at the time, aside from like Stockhausen?
I loved Kurt Weill, which is something. I mean, that was something you can. Much of my music that you can do, there's like FX Twin, it's like Ambient Works, Kurt Weill, and the latest that completely changed me was Francis Bébé, with his psychedelic Sansas. But these are 3 like really important records for me, like Drei Groschen Oper, 3 Penny Opera. Selected Ambient Works and the Psychedelic Sansas by Francis Bébé. But back at the time when I was listening to basically anything, every time something new on Warp or Reflex came out, I would just listen to it and see, can I buy this? Can I not? Because there was a lot of record shops where I was. I'd moved to Hamburg by that point, and I could just get all this beautiful music and of course, Autica was there, and there was like a direct connection. Autica beats, and then listening to Idiotech, that was like, this is Autica. This is Autica with someone singing over that. So, but that's the same thing and the same sound. And Yeah, but that's maybe that's also something about like when you grow up a bit and you hear a band and you're saying, this is all new, this is new, this is the newest thing ever, and then you hear all their influences
right
at some point, and you put it all into context, because there's nothing new, everything has a context.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a bit, what's it called, disillusionment.
Right.
But then you learn to appreciate that, mm-hmm. and to appreciate the continuum in which we all are. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Pansonic, of course. Pansonic. I have to mention Pansonic. Really important. Pansonic.
Yeah. Okay. So, were there any, I guess, milestones from when you started making music, like when you were 15 to where you're at now? Was there any big moments that you were like, wow, okay, it's really going somewhere sweet, you know?
I was generally happy to be able to live from purely music that was like 2008. So 10 years ago, I was able to live only from music. Didn't have to do any other jobs. That was like the most amazing point for me, because I had studied and worked during studies, and then I had worked a bit but then composing work at the same time that I got my first composing gigs for theater, and that went so well that I could concentrate on making only music. And mm-hmm. that was one of the biggest changes for me. And to not have to go to an office, to not have to talk to customers, to not have to write copy for an ad or something, to not have to do something, basically to sell stuff. And theater is beautiful in regards that it, in Germany at least, that it's very free, it's very political, it's an exciting playground. It allows you a lot of freedom. I could try out so much stuff there already, mm-hmm. that I couldn't have tried out any other way and get paid for that. And that was one of the biggest milestones. And of course, you know, like touring with a band, playing a summer festival tour, because I was in the wave pop band like all during university and a few years after. And we did festivals, and that was amazing for me to do a festival tour. But for me, I think the most magical time is now, because
yeah,
it's the first time, you know, that feeling when you're with what you do in the right time at the right place. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that feeling. I didn't know it for a long time. I was always the odd one out. But now with what I'm doing, it's just multiplying all the time, and I get all... I can do all these exciting things, and don't have to worry about too much about like when the next paycheck comes in or something.
Right.
Or when the I used to do also media music, you know, B2B
right.
stuff, and that's something I don't have to do now, because there's so much support on Patreon, for example. Mm-hmm. Which now enables me to start thinking about like doing travels and visiting places that I wouldn't have thought of going, because this support that I get there enables me to try out new stuff and basically finances new and exciting things. So that I want to try it. This is something I'm really going to start and work further on this year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yeah.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
Just biggest milestone is now, I think.
Yeah, I think also that I think about this a lot, that, you know, when a musician really is able to dedicate their life to their music and not have to really worry about, oh, how am I going to have a job and blah, blah, blah. The transformation of their actual music, that's really interesting to me. Like, did you notice a distinct change or like an increase in quality or whatever, being able to work on just music and not have to worry about paychecks and all of that?
I noticed, of course, when I first started the composition.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Cut that. Definitely. The thing is, if you're every day, all you're doing is music, and maybe you're Texas because that's something you also have to do. But if that's the only focus, it will get better because you are able to spend more time on it. So, and more time equals makes you a better player. It keeps you in the flow, and you can broaden your horizon musical wise so enormously. So that is something that I've noticed as compared to. I always, after university, I used to work like 3 days, and then I had 4 days for music, basically, or whatever. So after working the full day, I was usually pretty tired. So you can get 1 or 2 good hours of music in, but then it's nothing. It's done.
Right.
But if you've got a free day and another free day and 4 days, you can say, now I'm just going to do that. That is already pretty beautiful.
Yeah.
And now that it's 100% Heinbach also that I'm doing, I mean, I'm scoring theater. I've scored already 3 theater plays this year, and I'm working on a documentary, and I'm doing that all the time. But I've got so much time now also for my Heinbach music and what I want to do and develop. And I can justify putting more money and effort into everything because it gives me so much back. That's a definite change. I mean, the whole test equipment journey, it wouldn't have been possible before, because without all the good feedback, I couldn't even have afforded that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
that's cheap as it is.
That's something I think about a lot, you know, the amount of artists and stuff that really could, that don't get the chance to really dedicate a part of their life to their music, because I really think that, you know, the only way to really get there as a musician, which I'm not there, but so it might just be a guess, is to really say that you're going to do it and, you know, take the jump and say, I'm going to dedicate a certain amount of time to music and make it a priority, you know.
I mean, the formula that I came up with is really early on to make music to make more music is, I think it's a pretty good formula, because then you are able to just do music, and it can be, you find all these different avenues. Someone comes around and wants to, because you could learn all these skills, like recording someone. And some, can you record this? Or can you, then you're in a university, someone says, can you make me a spectrogram of this thing? And you can do that. You get all these kind of odd jobs suddenly because of all the skills you picked up around. And then you do theater because, oh, you're music, can you record? And can you run the show? Yes, I can. Okay, I'm going to do that. And you just have to think about, you don't have to be picky about the music that you do. You just make music to make more music and try to steer it in the direction that you enjoy. And then you have to stick to that for like 20 years. And then maybe something good might come out of that. So at least that's my story. So,
yeah. And, you know, to be honest, out of all the people we've had on here, we've had like the, co-founder of Ninja Tune and stuff, and without a doubt you have without a doubt the most like concrete drive behind your music that I've heard, like, you know, make music to make more music. So do you think that having the clear vision in mind of why you're making music is super important? Or
it is totally important. It's one of the, it's like it gives you a reference point from which you can oscillate in any direction. It's and I always have this basic setting for my music, and I hope it doesn't sound too pretentious, but there's this beautiful quote by Oscar Wilde, and he said, we're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. That's a feeling that I can completely relate to. Like, really, like, I don't know, after a long night out, you collapse on the pavement, and then you look up and you're messed up, and then you see the stars and you realize something. It gives you a context of the distance between misery and beauty. And that's a reference frame that I like to have philosophically underneath my music. And the next thing is, I've always been into exploration. I mean, the books that fascinated me as a child were like The Great Explorers, where they talked about the Arctic and the ancient world of the Aztecs and Mayans. And that was something that was so interesting to me. And of course, then space, all these ever traveling frontiers, and to go places in music, to go to the beautiful places that even like with in any instrument, there's this point, I think, where the thing that it wants to do breaks apart and it becomes more than it wants to do, or what it was designed for, and suddenly it opens up new uncharted territories. Same as with the Mogafoga I was talking about earlier, that just went into this bliss mode and started bringing out all these beautiful overtones. Every instrument has that. The piano, if you play it fast enough, there is a world, and then you start and then you prepare it, and suddenly it's a completely different instrument. Mm-hmm. And I'm always interested in these breaking points. And I try to, every time I get a new instrument or I get invited to beta test an instrument, I basically try to break it and try to find, not physically break it, but from see how far I can push it. And when it starts to overtake itself and overtake the idea that the creator had, and from there's so much. That's my way of discovering new things.
Right. And I do you think that nature of discovering new and, you know, pushing farther, and do you think that most likely pushed you farther into like the ambient and experimental modular synth world because of like connections and, you know, there's no rule book?
Exactly. There wasn't like back when I, the funny thing is when I started out, modular was seen as, with modular, it was seen as these bleep bloop machines that right. would be like really noisy and annoying. And you had a few people doing live shows here in Berlin, and it was really maybe 30, 40 people. And it was that visited, and it was always really listening shows and attentive, which I really liked, but it was all experimental. It was, all to its own structure. But then that kind of developed, funnily enough, it developed into wellness modular, like with the very softly modulated ambient sounds. Mm-hmm. And that happened right at a point of time when I was kind of like, okay, modular is like a tool or just another tool. And I had stopped buying new modules and was going into a Seat Lombardo world. And then all the basically pre-mutable instruments, and like right remutable instruments came along, and then suddenly everything became modular, became the ambient instrument, which was for me so funny because it was always a source of raw rhythms and tones and powerful stuff to me, and suddenly it got pushed through all the visual imagery, of course, also in YouTube and Instagram, to be this plucky technological thing that would harmonate perfectly well with a potted plant and drift into beautiful worlds. And I mean, there's artists that I love, like R. Benny and Brian Noll, Lightbath, which I really enjoy. And but it has become this meme of ambient rings into clouds, plingy plongy stuff. That's really crazy. Because modular used to be unpleasant,
right?
It used to be raw and yeah, you would find it like in techno, in hard techno, you would find in Berlin here, you would find modular a lot, and that was like the core. And then you would have these amazing artists that would play Surge, like Rustco and stuff.
Ah, yes.
And that would be that would be, for me, that was where it came from. this pivot and the general thing of the whole thing. I mean, it's good because it gave the instrument basically a more musical value, if you want to say that, and it turned it from something very obscure into something more popular, which I'm always for. I mean, all these experimental techniques, the more popular they get and the more known they get, and instruments, the better to me. The more noises in the charts, the more distortions, the more weird modulations, the more beautiful everything gets. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah, it is pretty nuts, you know, how popular modular synthesizers are getting. I guess the biggest thing that drew me to them, because, I mean, traditionally I was on piano and stuff, was just the visual look of them. It was just nuts, you know?
Yeah.
Seeing the big wall. I mean, Richard Devine, to me, mm-hmm. was like seeing his big stack of them. And then because and the way I've always looked at them is, you know, you take like a synth and then you just take out all the different individual parts and then mm-hmm. you look at it like that. But I mean, I think that every artist, in my opinion, should at some point try to involve a modular synth, just because it makes you think in such a strange way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Because else you're playing like the patch someone else thought of and designed yeah. beautifully, turned into an instrument and then gives to you, but it's still someone else's patch and someone 100%. Else's design. And then you can, of course, live with that and play it, and you focus on different things. But I've got a special thing with keyboards and synthesizers. I don't really enjoy keyboards on synthesizers. I think they're unnecessary, and they're they're just something that you put on so people won't get frightened. And right. And with what they used to, there's no physical need for a key to depress so low and hit something. That's mm-hmm. absolutely no need. And I love touch interfaces, but right. Now I kind of lost the point of your question.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, sort of touching that, you don't like having the keys on the keyboards then?
No, because it limits the synthesizer. It puts it all like into this nicely arrayed 12-tone array, which is, that's what I was thinking about. It again closes the instrument up. It sets it into this preconceived concept of music is chromatic and has 12 notes per octave. And you're only allowed to use a few of these. And synthesizers, I mean, the best way, I think, to play a synthesizer is by not playing the keys. So right. you put it, I just look at one of my standard, I've got a few analog standards here, like in Roland SH-01. I just put it on hold, and then I play like the hold for the VCA, and then I play it using all the modulations that it has and external right. modulations, and then it becomes something interesting. But when it goes mm-hmm. like, okay, so now I go to the dominant and then the subdominant and then again to the tonic, it's okay. I mean, it has its rules, like in songwriting and stuff, and there it's perfectly fine to have the keyboard again. But to actually play a synthesizer,
right,
I think means to play the knobs and play with the for sound sure. and not with the keys.
Yeah, and actually, that was one of the biggest things that kind of pulled me back to your channel in the last couple months, because I got this keyboard, an Octave Kitten, and the keybed is completely destroyed. It's absolutely mm-hmm. useless, and the only way I can play it is using the pitch knob. So, and it's a rusty potentiometer. So,
nice.
That was the keyboard I used for my first live show, actually, surprisingly. Because my Poly 6 broke the day before.
That's not
so after the show, I was like, there was some weird feeling. I was like, wow, that was so much more interesting. And I don't really know how to describe it, but just playing the synths using the tune knobs and stuff was just really... It felt really freeing from playing classical piano for, you know, so long. And then I started, you know, going on YouTube like I always do in the afternoon. And I started watching your channel again, and I saw the test equipment, and that resonated so deeply with mm-hmm. with the, I don't really know exactly the connection, because I guess doing it the way it's not really intended to be used was really powerful to me, you know.
And also the tuning is all you. Mm-hmm. with that stuff. You're not like set into this quantized set. The tuning is all what you think it is. And I find that oftentimes people have, like, when you just make them tune an instrument on their own, they come up with such interesting things. They come up with such mm-hmm. interesting ideas that are not there, that are off to what standard tuning is, which mm-hmm. is really beautiful. And
for sure.
I've learned tune by ear a lot, and I just love that. I never use a tuner. I think tuners right. are tuners. I don't know why. So maybe if I want to tune my piano or something, but I don't. Right. I got someone to do that for me. Mm-hmm. But I don't think. I think the ear is much more exciting to tune with, and that's with the test equipment. You've got 6 oscillators, and you want them to play different pitches, and you tune them all to different pitches. That's really nice. So to do that on your own and without a tuner and without a keyboard, and it frees you.
For sure. And I think there's something about that philosophy that this is all kind of tied up in. Like, what I teach a lot of people how to use Ableton, because I've been using it now for ever since I was about 6 years old in Lansing. But one of the ways that I think the coolest way to learn either tuning or pretty much anything when I'm going into music is I don't let people watch tutorials at all, especially with Ableton and really anything, because one of the coolest things for me is I put Ableton on someone's computer and then I say, all right, make a percussion drum beat or whatever. And I don't tell them how, and I don't let them look it up. And sometimes they'll come up with these super weird ways of making a drum beat, whether it's using like a sampler or some really strange way that you would never expect. And mm-hmm. you know, they have no experience, and it's just pure creativity, you know? And that's one of the coolest things, you know?
I absolutely know what you mean. The first time I opened up Ableton Live 1 when it came out, I threw in a bunch of sounds, and then I started slowing everything down, and I got these mass of stutter effects that mm-hmm. I knew how to get these like these granular sound kind of effects, but I could never do them like with 12 sounds at once.
Right.
That was such an eye opener, and I've been mm-hmm. converted to Ableton ever since. So because of the ease that you can mess things up in there and just go to different corners of your mind and your ideas.
Mm-hmm. And I think the DAW, honestly, like, is such an amazing invention, like, especially more open ones like Ableton, and I guess even Maxim SP, if you would consider that a DAW.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
I
think Ableton is just a Maxim SP patch, right? Basically,
pretty much, yeah. My dad was like deep into the Maxim SP. He knows a lot of the guys at Cycling 74 and used to teach it at mm-hmm. U of M. So I grew up a lot with the Maxim SP, always around. And I guess like when I saw that, when I started using Ableton, it was so open. Like, it wasn't something like GarageBand where it was like, you do this, you do this, you do this. And because there's so much there that like you don't even need to know or even ever think about, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess using like Ableton in your music, what are some things that you appreciate the most about like Ableton, using it for ambient and experimental stuff?
I don't use it that much anymore, because now it's more like a live machine. And I could mm-hmm. probably switch to any DAW now, because I mostly use them like tape recording. So, mm-hmm. and, but the thing that I enjoy about it, as I said, was like the way you can pitch down time, and
for
felt
sure.
like the whole interface, that it's modern, it has this heads up display kind of look, instead of like pretending to be an old tape machine or pretending to be a studio, which to the keys on a synthesizer that I hate. I hate a photorealistic look. Again, we don't like that. Functional. I'm a plugin. I can do this. Listen, flip four. I love this. I like working.
One sec. I think. Let me. I'm running off a hotspot. Let me just make sure that my it's plugged in real quick. Okay, here we go. All right, we are all. I'll have to cut this out. My studio has no Wi-Fi, so I have to use a hotspot on my phone.
Okay.
sec. Let me just make sure that my phone isn't going to die so we don't lose connection. There we go. So, yeah. And you're...
Same as with the keys on a synthesizer, I think this whole photorealism interface, it tells you the wrong story. Everything pretends to be something else, which it's not. It hides the code. It hides the... It's what it is. I don't like that. I like to work with the Ableton plugins and the clean interface and the precision that I can get there. And that's something that I really enjoy when working with Ableton, that it doesn't pretend Google, you know, that there's not many windows when I load Cubase. It's like all the software that I started out with. And it just isn't that much fun. I like the ease of use, basically.
For sure. So what have you, I watched the last YouTube video you put up and, like the live session, and that was, I think I've watched it probably through to the end twice now. It's, you know, absolutely awesome. Kalimba, the finger thumb piano thing that you're using, was that in the last one or was that an earlier one? But,
I think
that was... I've been thinking about actually using a thumb piano for a while because they have really cool tones, but like...
Thumb piano. Uh-huh. You can't call it a thumb piano because that's, again, that's like the imperialist term for that. Because, oh, what are the instruments? Oh, this is called an it's called a kalimba. This is called a rim. It's called so many things. It's called a zanza. There's so many names in Africa. Go. But then the Queen's came and said, so it's a thumb piano. And again, that makes this instrument much smaller than it is. Because then you think of it as a piano that you play with thumb. And it is this beautiful book called The Soul of Embira. And it goes about how this is, especially the ones, the Embiras, they're three people, a mother and a kid. And the deep notes are the head. The middle notes are the mother, the high note, and then you play them with thumb, with both and your index finger on the right. And that's, and they have a conversation. So it becomes a totally different thing. Think about that. And how communicate about this conversation between different figures and their intents compared to using. Oh, did I come through or not?
You seem to be coming through better now, but in the last sentence, it started breaking up. All right.
Back on Ethernet.
All right, yeah, I think that's much better now.
Yes. Good.
Cool. So, where were we?
We were about not calling it thumb piano.
right. Because yeah, my bad.
No, that's something you... It's cultural, I think. So, but one thing, but that ties in with when I mentioned Francis Bébé and the Psychedelic Sansa album. It's something that's really, really caught my ear and how to play this instrument. And that's something that I really, really want to learn. But at the same time that I got like my second one, and that's a really big one, that's really difficult to play, I got a bad case of tendonitis, and that lasted up until like a few months ago. So I couldn't really get into that.
Gotcha. Yeah, there's something I think about using new instruments, you know, whether it's test equipment or kalimba or a new synthesizer or anything that's just so freeing to not understand it, you know?
Yeah, the first phrase you always have to record when you get something new, you have to hit record immediately because for there's things you'll come up with that you will spend months trying to replicate later.
100%.
That first phase is always golden. I mean, it can sound like crap, but oftentimes there comes this stuff out that you definitely need to record.
Mm-hmm. What were some, aside from the Caitlin Bard, what were some synthesizers or pieces of equipment that you really found and you were like, wow, this is just so crazy cool.
Crusher X, that was a, that is still a granular synthesizer that came out, I think, in the early 2000s, which is always so full featured. And what you could do is you could basically scale up the complexity until your CPU wouldn't do it anymore. And it's this beautiful, it's a granular cloud synthesizer. And it would have a visualization of the clouds that you, of grains, and how they would drift and float around. It's an amazing instrument still. And I did a whole lot of music with that. So that was really important to me. Then there's the classic Juno 60, which is so damn useful. It's an instrument every time. It's a perfect instrument when the track is missing something. You can always use the Juno to tie it together. It will always give you something. It's not an instrument, I would say, it inspires me. It's just always useful. So it's,
for sure,
when you've got a context, it will fit in. I don't go like, okay, so I make a sound that never, hardly ever inspires me, the sound that I get from there, because it's really basic, but it does this thing great. Of course, then there's some... Then there's some stuff like Metasonics, for example. Metasonics does beautiful tube modules and instruments, like the vacuum tube drum machine, D1000, which is brutal and amazing. And the R54 super module, which is a filter, one-pass filter that can be used as a VCO. And was simply as a module on its own, sounds gorgeous. And in Eurorack world, there's the Schwaemann RES4, which is 4 bandpass filters. And this is a module that is, I'm never going to lose that, because it sounds like nothing else. And you can do, it's so open. I mean, bandpass filters, they're like the most underrated thing in synthesis.
For sure.
I mean, I got a new Digitone also, and they've got a filter section on that amp synthesizer, which I find crazy. But they don't have a bandpass filter. And I was like, why is there no bandpass filter? Bandpass filter is super important, and you can do so many beautiful things with it. And I don't like everything has to be low pass or high pass. So high pass is even rare, but but bandpass is great. So that's RES4. And the Omnicord, when it's modded nicely by someone, Folktech. I've got the Folktech one, which is a really good mod, and you can play whole shows with that and maybe like a delay.
Yeah,
it's 100%. all you need, and I've done that. And then the biggest instrument that I would say is amazing to me is the Nagra 4.2, or even
the tape recorder.
Yeah, so that's just. It's an instrument. It can be used in so many ways. It's again one of these limitless tools where you can use it in ways that it was not intended to, and it just, every time you touch it, everything feels good. It's machined in a way that things will never be machined again.
Right.
You can feel that. I love, that's also something I like about test equipment. These things were made to a standard, to the highest standard. And you don't see like these kind of standards, things being built to that standard, at least in the music world, again.
For sure. And about that, actually, because I, one of my jobs is I repair synthesizers and music equipment. I've noticed that actually today, I turned one of my old Thomas organs. I ripped out the keys out of it and I turned it into a stand for my Poly 6. So it sits where the keys were, and then the top of the organ is another stuff. And you know, the design on the older stuff, the way it's designed to be serviced, with it had like the keys on it all have hinges. So you can open the entire thing up and work on it. It's so easy. And then I was working on a, what was it, like a Mini Brute one time, and it was such a pain.
No, like, that doesn't, no, that's hard.
Even the bigger stuff, like the Poly 6, even it's well designed and stuff, but like you can still tell that it's not as friendly to work on.
No. And then you get newer stuff. You get SMD, and that's
That
becomes really hard to service. So
100%. I have the new Behringer MS-101. I haven't opened it up yet. I'm going to be doing that in the next few days, but hopefully it won't be as SMD mount. But with modular synthesizers, do you ever like work on your own, messing around with the actual circuits, or
no?
Just okay.
I've done some building before, but mostly kits. And I don't have a workshop space where I can actually do that. So I always have to put it up on the kitchen table, and that gives me a time limit until the family comes back. And that's not something you want to do when you're not that experienced with soldering. You want to have time, you want to be able to trouble check, but if you have to tread on everything, that really sucks. So I decided, no, I'm not going to do this until I've got a space to do this. And sometimes I go now, when I want to repair something, I go to like my friends' places, like Common Ground or Patch Point in Berlin. And then I ask them if I can use one of their stations and stuff like that. I don't have much time for messing with the circuits themselves. Mm.
Do you ever think like it would be really cool to like design your own synthesizer from scratch or something?
Definitely. I mean, like, I do a lot of beta testing, and I give a lot of feedback already to like existing manufacturers and what they're doing, and I have a little bit of influence in that regard.
Right.
But to do something on my own, that or like, to design something, that would be beautiful. So,
And actually, I can talk about this after we stop recording. But what are some like manufacturers, or if you, aside from like Sid Lombard, that you really find that their designs and stuff are very, not inspiring, like really, really well designed, that you use a lot?
The prime now is of course Rode & Schwarz, which is the UBM filter that I'm using from the 50s. The same one as Stockhausen used, not the exact same unit, but it's crazily built. It's built to the highest standard. It sounds like nothing else. It sounds amazing. It's one of the most inspiring instruments I've been working with, actually. And something like, as I mentioned before, that I have the Digitone from Electron, and that's actually really beautiful to work with, and the flow and the UI and the way it sounds and everything is really nicely laid out. It sometimes doesn't go as far as I want. Usually I want audio rate modulation and everything doesn't do it. Like if it's audio rate, it doesn't go high enough. Part again, why I like a test equipment, because that's so unlimited. But it's still nice. I mean, it's very, very easy to program, very musical, and I enjoy it. And the build, I enjoy like when something is like little, you know, when you hit the knob, it goes like twang, twang, and it's hard. And I like physicality to the instruments.
For sure.
And I like toy pianos, of course. I've got a few toy pianos, and there's the Michel Zon 37 touches, 37 keys, which is one of the most beautiful toy pianos I've ever seen and played. And I think everything like from Moog, all the Moogafugers, all these big pedals, shame that they discontinued, those are really, really great designed instruments.
For sure. And one of the things that I talk to people a lot about, not on the podcast, but more like personally, is the whole methodology of like, you know, you don't need nice equipment to make stuff. And we'll say like the equipment isn't as important to the music production. What do you have to say about that kind of stuff?
It can make life much easier to have nice equipment. I mean, even my most lo-fi tracks, they run through A-Design preamps, so nice transformers. They are oftentimes recorded either on a Telefunken M15 tape machine, which gives it like an automatical mixing thing. It rounds out everything nicely. And they run through a Buckbrand stereo compressor, which is, so it's really a really, really good chain through which everything runs and makes it sound good. And that takes away time that I would else have spent mixing and makes me concentrate more on the music. Because I know once this hits the tape at a certain level, it will sound great. And even if I'm recording to on the go, I've got a really high-end recorder, really high-end, but like I've got a Sony PCMD100, which just sounds so good. It sounds good. I prefer it like even to my RME interface in the way that this thing sounds. So that makes it for me easier to feel something to the music because I'm very texture-based, so I make better music. And so I think something like the bones of everything matter, something like the ADDA conversion, that's something that matters to me, especially as I'm in a room that's treated with nice speakers. And or even, but then again, of course, I can just make a track on the OP1 and call it a day. So and that's lo-fi as lo-fi will get. So the idea will always trump that. But when I'm working on something that that I really want to sound great, I've got all the tools that I need to make it sound great and give it like a more emotional and deeper impact.
For sure. Yeah, my thoughts on it were always like, you know, synthesizers and stuff, they're not as much like luxury the way that a sports car is, but they're much more closer to like tools in a tool shop.
Definitely, there are tools. They used to be luxury cars.
Yeah.
They used to be as expensive as those. They used to be definite in that compartment, and only the richest of the rich or universities or something could afford them. But now they're really a common commodity. But I wouldn't worry like about the sound of this, it's just so much as long as it's the sound is more important that it touches you. So what I was talking about is like production value that you're adding, and production value is something that comes from mixing. But let me tell you, I often mix like on cheap 15 euro headphones and record my music with something like that, and then in the end I just use Ableton Equalizer and some limiter, and then it's done. Because at some point, you know your tools and what you can do and what you're trying to achieve and what you want to achieve with the tools that you use. So you're not going to try to make like a Berghain already techno track on the OP1. I'm not going to. That would be like, that would be a bit, that would be an uphill battle at least. So, but something really emotional and touching is really easy to do on with just a dictaphone and an organelle or any piano you find on the street. So you can touch emotions more easily. But of course, mixing wise, there are some things that will make your music, even if it's the most noisy and experimental music, sound good across speaker systems. And that's something basically technically that you want, I think. You want your music to not sound only good on your gear, or but you want it to sound good, or at least maybe not call it good, but get the necessary information over on every speaker system. And a producer that I work with, he used to call it with the German word Lesbarkeit, which means readability. Can you read the signal? Can you see it in front of your eyes? Can you, what is it? Can you understand it? And that's a concept that I really like in mixing, for example, readability. And
Yeah, about that, I've noticed actually recently, because I drive with my girlfriend a lot, and her car has horrendously bad speakers that are completely blown. And I've noticed that like pop music sounds amazing on them, whereas Radiohead sounds horrible. And yeah. You go ahead.
No, that's because Radiohead is also a level of noise in them that makes it difficult, that when the system is already noisy and you add distortion upon distortion.
For sure.
So, and that will like overblow it, while most pop music is produced so sparse when you're talking about really the top of the charts that it has almost a test tone quality in some regards. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to punch through. And I mean, the best test in any car and in anything you go, like the music that will always work is like Bob Marley records. Indonesia, like in these tiny little cars that they have with the blown up bad sound systems or tiny radio there. This sounds great all over the world in any mm-hmm. sound system.
So about earlier, you're saying like with the emotional connection and stuff, why do you think you make music? Why do you think you make it? Why do you release it?
Because I feel music is an act of communication. And mm-hmm. I used to be a really, I don't talk about my emotions kind of guy, which I've changed. Right. I used to talk about the most important emotional stuff for me in my music. So I wanted people to hear it. So they would know how I am and how I feel. But I think music is only really happening if it's heard. It's when there's no one there to listen to it, it's a bit empty because mm-hmm. you want to get the air vibrating and it's all waves and you want those waves to touch eardrums. And if that's not happening, it becomes kind of sad. I mean, you can do sheet music and people can read it, but then you still need someone to read it. So I like releasing music to get it out to people and find new audiences and connect with people, basically. For me, music is connection. And then there was a beautiful time, for example, on my YouTube channel, when it wasn't that big, it was below 10,000 subscribers. Mm. And not that it's super big now, but it was below 10,000. But people were writing poetry, basically. The comments were poetry. People were writing what they felt to the music and what space it put them in, and it was beautiful to see. And that was a really amazing time that lasted about 2-3 months, and then more people came in and it all got shut down by, I don't know, too many people there. And suddenly the small community of people sharing their innermost ideas and poetry got lost. But that was like an ideal situation for me because I could hear what the mostly abstract music that I do evoked in people.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Yeah. That's really cool, actually. That's actually really beautiful. Yeah. That must have been a really crazy awesome feeling, though.
That was for me, feel like pen pals or like, I don't know. It felt like a poet's corner or something. I don't know.
Right.
It was a rare thing, and it won't come again. I don't think now. Now it's mm-hmm. done. It was a beautiful point in time.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think your music comes from? I mean, obviously, it comes from like where you're making it, but like what we talk about a lot, me and my friend, is the concept of like music comes from somewhere else, like wherever it is. And like, what's your thoughts about that? Like, where do you think music comes from? Like, what makes it different than just like noise?
It comes from everything I've listened to before, and that comes from everything I'm searching for. That's the straight philosophical answer for me. But to give you like your question was almost about was something different. What makes it different from noise, just noise? Mm-hmm. There's like a whole. I love the concepts of I'm drawing a blank. Crazy. 433. 433, American composer, made first money by winning an Italian game show about mushrooms. John Cage. Exactly.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
So John Cage, I loved the concepts about what he considers music and performance and all of that. So I think with music, there's some music from noise. There has to be some kind of rule implemented, even if that rule can be aleatoric or randomized in itself. And there has to be a listener to receive it. That's basically the bare minimum of what music is, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good way to think about it, actually. Funny enough, I have a John Cage cassette right here on my desk.
Nice.
Yeah, that's a great way of going about the thoughts behind it. I really think that some of the most interesting things about talking to musicians is the reason behind their music. Like, because I think this, the scene that we're in right now with AI and everything, in the future, you know, robots will be able to make, in quotations, music if they were trained well enough. But I think the most interesting thing is the drive behind music. And that, I think, gives it the most depth, you know.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I can what only do agree you, to that. Hmm? What would you say if you could, in one sentence or two, kind of, what would you want your people to say about you in the future? Like, Heinbach. Yeah, he. Like, what would you want to be known for if you could pick anything?
Heinbach, he taught me this and that. Heinbach, his music made me cry. Two things, two reactions. Could be pretty good. Like that. I like the teaching part now a lot. So that's something I would be really happy. I like being kind of like a musician's musician also.
That's exactly how I came to your channel. Have you ever considered doing like more like academic, like giving lectures about music?
I have, but right now I'm more interested into the art, in art generally. I'm more like, I want to be, before I'd always prefer like an art project before an academic project right now.
For sure. So,
and if I can combine the two, that would be awesome. But I can do, because I've got like a magister, which is similar to a master of arts. So I can do talks and stuff like that. And I've often thought about like the script. I don't script my videos and anything, but I've often thought about, I want to write more. So that's something I want to do in the future. I want to write like Medium articles and stuff like that, because I think the written word gives way too more complexity than what I can do in a YouTube video, which is really, because I don't script them, it's very much how I would talk to a friend, you know?
Right.
And it's a different thing compared to, yeah, doing an essay and going into all the different possibilities and creating complexity and then breaking it down again. So that's something I am interested in the future, but right now, I'm more into creating and experimenting and stuff like that. Yeah. And I've been infected, of course, by my YouTube buddies like Sam Lokmang No Computer and Simon the Magpie. And that's just the love because they are masters in creating their own projects, like for experiments. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I kind of get more into. I'm got kicked off in me by working with them also and watching what they're doing, because basically I've been assigned to experiment also, like my theater work a lot. I've always made sound experiments, but I've often gotten like external impetus. So it's like, this is the play. Can we do something like this? Have you got an idea? So there's like, there's a set world. And from there, I can develop ideas. So, to develop the whole world by myself, that's something new for me.
Right. So, Yeah, and about the YouTube thing, like, it's pretty crazy how much the appeal for music, like, I don't know, music personalities and channels are, like, Andrew Huang and like Sam and the Magpie and stuff. Do you think that, like, how do I phrase this? That being on YouTube really changed your music perspective? I don't know how to word this. Like being on there and having that as a platform with video and the semi-social media aspect of that and the community and stuff, do you think that that changed your music and stuff in general a lot, or?
Not probably. I think it pushed me into the direction that I was going for anyway, because I was going for the one take thing a lot. I was pushing for mm-hmm. that in my, and that's how I said, I was starting out by doing these one take performances. And, that's basically where I wanted to go. And YouTube helped me in that, because it makes, for me, it makes for compelling visual to see someone perform a piece of music in one take, which is what I do when I perform music. Video, it's usually in one take, maybe with one or two overdubs later on, but usually it's one take, because that's, for me, that I get into a flow state where I do my most beautiful decisions, where I'm not overthinking stuff, where I'm feeling, reacting, it's all one. And YouTube supports that and the format of these kind of live videos, at least the form that I chose. Mm-hmm. So it enforced that in a way, and I've really gotten away from the more multi-tracking and more complexity approach, or I try to create complexity through in the one-take world, which is always challenging and beautiful to do. So it challenged me more. It has given me this thing where I do performances with no safety net, which makes my music better, because I think my worst enemy always is overthinking. That's something, that's the thing, like with multi-tracking, to record. I don't like the approach of record so much stuff and then mute stuff. I don't like that. I don't really like that. I think just know the note that you want to play. Shape that one note, shape that two notes. And they've got two notes and they sound perfect and they're so emotional. That's all you need. And that's something I've been striving for, like, for decades now. And with the all live setup and that and the live music that I'm documenting on YouTube and that I play live when I go out and play shows, that's where I want to be. So it has helped. It has helped me and it has supported me in doing that.
For sure. What would you say, like, if you had to give advice, because for people who wanted to start bringing their music and life to more onto YouTube, and, like, for example, say someone made music all the time and they really wanted to start going to YouTube, what advice would you give newcomers to going onto YouTube and stuff?
Be passionate. Don't try to copy anything. I mean, okay, or the, but no, copy strongly. Copy techniques. Copy, like, camera angles. Copy, like, learn, because that's something most musicians don't know. So you look what works visually. What works, what are all these things? And you can just watch a whole bunch of YouTube videos, make notes, and watch films, and read a book on cinematography and stuff, and then work that out. But just, I think what I personally like about YouTube is that you see someone living their passions. And I follow a lot of channels that I've got no interest in, like, what they're actually doing, but I see the person as a passion. And it's that alone makes it interesting for me. They're selling their topic interestingly. So that's the thing, to never try to push anything and just be passionate about yourself. And don't look at the screen. Don't look at the small screen next to the camera. Look into the lens. That was hard for me to learn. I mean, like, I can't look at my earlier videos now, like stuff that I started out when I started out talking to camera. I can't, it's horror for me. I still think, okay, you say some good things, but the way you say them is like, oh God. So, I mean, I've got the language barrier too. It's a second language. So you don't know how many takes I have to do because I mispronounce something. And synthesizer is really a difficult word.
Synthesizer. I think it's a Japanese word, though, if I'm synthesizer.
It's Greek.
Oh, Greek. Of course. Yeah. Because I know that the SH-101, it was because of the Sennheiser, I think. Mm. So that's where the SH came from, actually. But, yeah, because we're reaching, I think, probably close to an hour and a half now.
Yeah. My voice is getting a bit sore.
So I guess as a final kind of wrap up, what would you kind of, if you could give anyone advice to coming into music, I guess is the whole point of the podcast, is people who don't really know whether or not they want to be a musician or whether or not they want to take the next step in doing music, or even if they're just observing music, what would you give advice wise? If you could just tell everyone something, what would it be?
Get on stage and see if you like being on stage. I think performing music for other people, that's where you'll know if you love it or not. You don't even have to go on stage. If you've got a voice, you could sing. So you could just sing something. And if you enjoy singing to other people and you get a feedback, oh, that's not half bad or something, or that is bad, please stop it. And then you can do a noise like, I don't know. But just if you enjoy it, then it's good. So anything that gets you out and gets you to express yourself is good, I would say, in that regard, artistically. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Get on stage, sing in the shower, sing loud in the shower so the person in the room next to you notices it. And then don't be shy. Don't be shy is probably the what it all comes down to.
Mm-hmm. And I guess as a final question now, if you could have us interview anyone, regardless of how hard it would be to get them, who do you think who would you want to see interviewed or on the podcast?
Oh, I think you would love to talk to Peter Blusser of Sheared Lombard, but he's great.
I'm trying to get in contact with him actually right now.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. He's super interesting. You can go deep, and it's beautiful.
Sweet. So, yeah, we'll have to do that for sure then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess we'll kind of wrap this up. Thanks for coming on and spending some time talking with us. It was absolutely awesome and had a great time.
You're welcome. I had a good time too.
Thanks. So this was Heinbach. This was our 9th episode of the podcast. Feel free to check out the links in the description. We'll have links to Heinbach's Patreon, all of this music, all that good stuff. And feel free to like and subscribe and check out both of our stuff.